So this is the first time we've done a topical discussion in the past. It's always been different sort of groups of emerging managers and endowments and family offices and that kind of stuff. So thank you for joining me in this little experiment. And you know, I think one of the most sort of pressing questions or interesting questions for investors today is, you know, what to do about China. Everybody sees the economy is incredibly successful. It has these great companies. Very, very cheap valuations, but on the other hand, there's Trump and there's Taiwan and there's the experience we saw vicariously with Russia over the last few years. So I think people are sort of trying to figure out what to make of this. And so it's a very topical question we have today, and I'm really looking forward to the discussion. I've got four panelists here who I'm about to introduce you to. All four were very keen to point out they don't view themselves as China experts per se. They don't spend their entire life thinking about China or that. They're all four first-class global investors, but who have, and as they will surely explain, you know, there's a certain amount of exposure and time they've spent in China. So I think the expectation should be a sort of a big picture view of the country and views of the country, as opposed to someone who's sort of people who are super deep into the weeds of China. In terms of the question that I posed at the start is, you know, is China investable? That was, of course, meant slightly provocatively. Of course, any asset is investable at the right price. And I think there was an analyst last year who said something along the lines of that China is uninvestable. And you know, what does that mean? If you were offered the entire stock market for $1, would you decline it? Of course not. So everything is a question of price. So we won't go too far down that road. But there are issues and pros and cons. And so that's definitely what will be our topic today. So with those introductory comments, I'll ask each of you to briefly introduce yourself. Maybe you could tell a little bit about your funds and what your relationship to China and Asia is. Sure.
Do you have one?
I don't. Good morning, everyone. My name is Graham Rhodes. I'm from Hong Kong, was born and raised there. I run an investment management company there called Long River. I invest in public equities globally. It's really quite an honor to be here. I've been watching these events on YouTube since 2017. And with a few friends, some of whom are here today, like Andrew Burns, James Ferguson, Carlo Gioja, we actually took the inspiration from this event to start one in Hong Kong, which is where I got to meet Rob last year. And let me tell you, when Rob Vinnell starts visiting your market, something interesting is going on. And if he visits twice, it's really interesting. So I'm really delighted to be here and very happy to share with you all what I know.
And Graham, I really enjoyed the conference you organized. Thank you again for inviting me to that. Yixin.
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Yixin La. I run an equity long short fund out of Tokyo. But I call my strategy China Nexus, means I have China direct exposure. I have China exposure companies, so I would long and short stocks in other markets, but that has a significant China exposure. And then I will have investments in business outside China, but based on my experience in China, if you can say that way. So I thank you again, Rob, for inviting me, and it's been great for me to be here. I really loved ambience here and loved the audience here and connection with everybody.
Yeah, and just while you still have the microphone, you grew up in China, if I remember correctly.
Yes, born and raised in Shanghai. A quick background on myself. Born and raised in Shanghai, so I probably one of the shortest investment experience for a lot of people here, because if I didn't know what an EPS is until my mid-20s. Start my investment career and was a private equity firm called City Capital in China. And then after business school, moved to public market and been doing public investing since 2012.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Fred.
Sure. My name is Fred Liu. I run a firm called Hayden Capital. We're global investors, concentrated predominantly long only. And we've been investing in China for a while now. Generally, it has been a lower percent of our portfolio, but we really ramped it up in 2022. My background is I'm actually Chinese American. My parents immigrated to the US in the late 80s. I was raised in the US, but I've spent a significant amount of time traveling back and forth. So I view myself as multicultural and literally just came back from China less than a week ago.
Yeah. Probably visiting relatives back in China or?
Yes, and yeah. Eating good food.
Perfect. And Sophia?
Hi, my name is Sophia. First, I have to issue a CYA for compliance that all of my views and opinions are of my own. So now that's out of the way.
We only want your opinion, so that's fine.
I'm an international and global investor, so I work at a long-only fund. We're very long-only. Our benchmark is very much like MSCI World X US or like a global benchmark. So, you know, there's a portion of the benchmark that is still in China. And I grew up until I was 6 years old in China. And then I moved to Canada, where I had most of my education until US college. And luckily, when I fell into investing right out of college, I fell into the time when actually the first wave of the honeymoon period started with China, with Alibaba's IPO. I was the only Chinese or Mandarin speaker on the team, and they just sent me there to do due diligence. So I kind of saw through this period as a lot of global capital came into China and kind of saw the waves of it. And my best thing for China, and I love the country, is because it justifies, like, wow, Chinese investing justifies all the numbers of hours I spend binge watching Chinese dramas. So that's kind of like why I want to continue to continue justify my hobbies.
Yeah, what I love about all four of you is that you're all managing global funds, so you don't have an axe to grind. If everyone was running a China fund, they'd probably be saying, oh, you've got to invest in China. But you guys, you can invest in China if you want, you don't have to. So I think you're quite objective about that. So a lot of the group here won't have been to China, certainly since COVID, and potentially not even before COVID. So I think there's a lot of question marks. People simply don't know what's happening there. So maybe one or two of you could just paint a picture of what you see in modern China, especially in the tier one cities when you go there today. Who'd like to take that one? Fred, you go first then.
I mean, I think the last couple of years has been pretty traumatic for a lot of Chinese families, especially tier one households and those with a lot of investable assets. So your real estate prices in a lot of cities are down 30%, 20%, et cetera. I think recently with policy changes, you've maybe seen some stabilization, a little bit more optimism in the last couple months, and you're starting to see signs of green shoots. But you know, from a consumer sentiment standpoint or consumer confidence or investor confidence standpoint, it's still pretty pessimistic. But day-to-day life is going on normally. All the restaurants are full. There's lines out the door. People are still, living life. Yeah.
And maybe one of you would like to describe what modern China looks like. So what do you see when you go to a tier one city today? Should one expect a sort of, I guess, normally you have the name communism in the name of the country. Is it a communist place or what do you see? Yeah, Yixin, why don't you take that one?
There are definitely elements of that, but I mean, it depends on where you go. So I have the luck of growing up in Shanghai and see this tremendous change of the city since the 80s all the way to today. If you visit it in 90s, it will be something like Cuba. We will have the communism huge square and all the buildings representing Soviet Union's age. And if you visit it in 2005 to 2010, you'll be like, this is the best city in the world. Why is Tokyo look so old? And I think 2023, November 2022 is when the government lifted the lockdown. And spring 2023, I went back to see my family and walk down the street. That was probably the most depressing moment in my relationship with my home city. I took a 2-hour walk from the center of the city, from, for anyone knows Shanghai, West Nanjing Road, where a lot of the commercial spaces were, all the way down to the bar area in Xintiandi, and I counted less than 5 foreigners. And I was like, this is not Shanghai. We're known for a trading city. We're known for having a very diversified culture. During my adulthood, it's always been the world's best chef came to Shanghai. We have the best bars, everything. But that was probably the lowest point. From that point, it has bounced back. My last few trips back, seeing more international people, seeing the city coming back to more constructions and continued innovation, especially on retail and tech fronts. You are seeing, even though it's a very depressing environment for entrepreneurs, their VC capital has dried up. PE capital has dried up. They're still find ways to build new business and keep it growing.
Can I add something like that?
Okay, so I think the question was, like, what would you go if you see there, and could you tell if China's a communist country? I think it's really important for everyone here who hasn't been to China or who hasn't invested there before to understand the Chinese model of economic development. And the starkest reality is to look at the per capita income of the average Chinese person over the last 30 years and to see how that's gone up. I forget the exact number, but let's say it's 20x. And then to compare that to the MSCI China index, which has been virtually flat over the same period of time. So clearly there's a disconnect between what's been working for society, building a prosperous society, and what's been the return delivered to minority shareholders in aggregate and public companies, because yeah, the latter's kind of sucked. And we were talking about, like, is this a communist country? I think, first of all, it's important to recognize and at least acknowledge that China is a communist country. This is the governing ideology of the place. And that's how they have operated and built, like, their structure. And number two, as far as we're concerned, the state still plays, like, a very important and fundamental role in capital allocation across the economy. So the state every 5 years sets its plans, five-year plans. They target, like, different industries or regions for development, and they allocate capital either through credit, tax breaks, or giving out land. And that is why, like, you know, you have 100 plus EV manufacturers, because every local government wants to, you know, develop their own local industry or take advantage of subsidies in one form or another. And I think the disconnect between, like, what has been very good for the Chinese people and very bad for investors and public companies is that supply comes online very quickly and very fast. But that supply is, like, the death knell for good returns on equity. So I think that's, like, a really important point that I want to emphasize. Thank you.
Yeah, and maybe just to add, I think labeling countries as communist, socialist, democratic, autocratic, it's very hard because those come with inherent biases about how a system actually works. And so, you know, as an investor, I try to strip away all those titles and see how integrated is this country into the world economy. Are they following laws or rules, and is there, like, private property protection? And then if I start to go down the checklist, I just try to think about it in terms of aspect of how I can understand it as an investor and facts to make opinions about, hey, what are the things that can generate returns over time? What are the things that are immune to more of that supply dynamics? And so that is a better way to kind of, I think about a country as opposed to using labels, because when you use a word like communism, you kind of put, like, China and Cuba in the same bucket. And those two countries are very different in the way that they actually work from a government and economic legal perspective.
Yeah, I would just lastly add that from a business perspective, I think China is probably one of the most capitalistic and Darwinistic places to ever exist. Starting a business is very, very tough. There's a lot of people, there's a lot of competition. And so kind of, if you can...
It's tough in the sense of the competition, not tough in terms of
exactly
being allowed
yeah,
to sell.
Yeah, in terms of standing out above the competition. So, you know, Graham alluded to, like, the EV industry, a lot of restaurants, a lot of consumer brands. When you start to rise to the top and can make it in China, it kind of means that you're probably at a global level and of global quality that you can start moving abroad. And so we're starting to see that this year. We're starting to see a lot of bubble tea chains, whether that's Haiti just launched in LA and New York. Luckin is going to come to the US. Heidi Lau has already been here for many years. So you're starting to see Chinese consumer brands start to appeal to a global consumer as well.
Yeah.
The last thing I would also say is that when you look at China, you probably have to look at it from a different lens than a Western perspective, especially reading the Western media in the last 2 years. It's been a little bit frustrating, just because, for instance, a lot of people talk about why doesn't government just flood consumer stimulus into China, similar to what the US did. And it just doesn't necessarily work. Because the needs of, say, someone in Shanghai versus Changsha versus, like, a tier 5 city, like, it's just very, very different. So decisions need to be pushed down to a local level, and this local governments are in very different financial places at the moment. Yeah.
So just getting triggered on what Graham was saying. If you look at China overall versus 30, 40 years ago, we're a very capitalist country in the terms of 90% people are employed by private companies. When I grew up, Both my parents work for state-owned companies. 90% of the population work for state-owned companies or government. Today is no longer the case. If you look at GDP contribution, private sector is probably 50% versus 50-50 to the state. Then if you look at the asset base or bank financing, 90% go to the state-owned system. So the country has very different sectors, and depends on which sectors you're investing in, you can be super efficient. So all the private dominant sectors like internet, consumer, is cutting throat competition. Only the fittest can survive. But if you're talking about state-owned sectors, have a different rule of the game. I'm not saying they're not competitive, but they're different kind of competitive. So it is still a very mixed state, and I wouldn't call it communism, maybe a state capitalism.
I want to make two points. Well, to illustrate one example again about like a common fallacy that I've made, and I think a lot of other people have too, is to focus on demand and the opportunity for growth in China. And one example that I've heard recently is coffee. So, you know, you have all these studies which say like the per capita coffee consumption in China is like 1/20th or whatever it is in the UK or in America. Massive opportunity to grow. But as an investor in China, like you really have to pay attention to supply more than anything else. And there's this wonderful company you guys might have heard of called Luckin Coffee. Which when it IPO'd, like they cooked the books, all that kind of thing, went really bad. Crazily enough, the guy who founded Luckin was a fraud, was kicked out of Luckin, left, and then started another coffee company called Coddy. And lo and behold, through franchising, he's been basically cut out of any kind of like capital markets now, but through franchising, he's grown his store count to almost rival Luckin's again. Yeah. And in the space of about like 18 to 24 months, it's really crazy. And then other companies see like coffee and kind of see stars in their eyes. And now like Yum China is adding a cafe to like every outlet. So yeah, again, like demand seems very seductive, but really you got to focus on supply.
Yeah, and the crazy thing there is as well, even though Luckin was cooking the books, like you say, it's still gone on to become an incredibly successful company. So that's some of the contradictions you have in China.
And if I could just take another step back, and sorry for doing that, I want to give everyone here like a higher level overview of where I think China is today in terms that you might be able to relate to. So ever since 2008, China grew its economy primarily through fixed asset investment, either in infrastructure or residential real estate. The residential real estate market got very overheated. And in 2021, the government finally said, you know, we're going to deflate this bubble and try to transition the economy away to a more healthier footing. So for the last 3 years, China has been undergoing this massive deleveraging. It's been very painful. And the analogy that I think might help you to understand this is to think about the US circa 2010, 2011. So the subprime crisis like popped, I think, in 2006, but it took a long time for the US economy to repair its balance sheet. And during that time, like aggregate demand was very weak. You know, the economy was constantly like flirting in and out of recession. Monetary policy was cut to zero and was having no influence kind of thing. Animal spirits were in the dumps. And that's basically where China is today, like in very, very loose terms. So in addition to like all the things we're talking about, I want you to have that economic backdrop in mind, because there's definitely some important and very difficult headwinds that China is facing today.
Yeah. Without wanting to ask too much of a leading question, but I will do anyway. You know, I think one of the associations with a state-led economy is very slow, inefficient companies. Clearly, that's not the case in China. Maybe you can just describe the dynamism of Chinese companies you see. Sophia, why don't you grab that one?
Sure. I mean, I think I want to echo the sentiments of all the panelists up here. It is like the country with the fastest amount of supply growth for any particular sector that I've ever seen. So I'll have an example in autos, actually, because I was having a lot of conversation with auto manufacturers, chip makers, and in particular, how fast the electric vehicle development in China has been. I mean, before, right, Europe, America, on the forefront of electrification. But now if you look at for every car that is bought, I think in China, something's like 40% of new cars are like already electric. And we're talking this year, more than that, yeah, like we're talking this year, you know, Europe and US actually might go back to more hybrid and even combustion vehicles. And when you look at the development cycles of electric vehicles, a lot of of the auto chip companies would come out and say, like, I have never worked with companies where the product cycles have actually decreased as complexity has evolved. So if they're working with like the European counterpart, maybe the product cycle would be like 4 years or even longer. But when they're working with a Chinese electric first company, it's so short, it's like 18 months, 24 months. So the accelerated development in China for some of these industries is at an incredible pace that if, you know, as they think about exporting electric vehicles to other places, they're gonna be extremely cost competitive. And what that means in terms of pricing from a supply and demand perspective. So in China, I was reading this statistic where like for a sedan, electric sedan in China is probably like 30% cheaper if you were to buy as a consumer, whereas in the developed market, it's actually at a 20%, 30% premium, and that goes actually higher the larger cars you get to, like SUVs. So as you think about these type of dynamics and how fast China is actually moving in competition, supply growth, and innovation, it's actually pretty spectacular.
Yeah, I have so many questions. Fred, go on, and then I'm gonna ask another one.
I was just gonna add, I think something that's really unique to China is just the integrated supply chain, you know, what Sophia was talking about. Because, you know, a lot of our partners, you know, some of them based in China actually run factories. And so I've had conversations with them over the last couple of years about, you know, they're getting pressure from their own clients, many of them, whether Japanese brands, Western brands, et cetera, to move offshore, out of China. And so they talk about opening factories in Indonesia, in Vietnam, et cetera. But the one gripe that they constantly have is that, yes, labor costs are lower. Maybe it's, you know, 30% lower. But the inefficient supply chain actually really kills them. So for instance, if you're manufacturing in Vietnam, it might take a day or longer or, you know, a week for your parts to arrive, right? And sometimes you have to hold excess inventory inside of your factory to, you know, manage these uncertain timing, et cetera. In China, your supplier factory is probably 20 minutes away. You need extra parts, it's coming, you know, very, very quickly. In addition to a lot of these other countries just don't have the skill set or knowledge base in order to, you know, have great quality control. And so you have to do extra checks, so it's extra layers of costs on your business. So oftentimes when you manufacture abroad, it's probably 10% or 15% more expensive than manufacturing in China, even though labor costs in China, you know, workers are probably getting paid 10,000 or more RMB per month with extra holidays, et cetera.
Yeah, that kind of anticipates a little bit my next question, because one of the things, I think there was this perception in the West, certainly 10 years ago, maybe even to lesser extent today, but it still exists, that Chinese people have always been super hardworking, but the economy would always be focused on sort of commodity, sort of manually intensive sort of jobs. And I think up until about 5 or 6 years ago, there wasn't any sort of single important Chinese international company of note. And then the last 5 years, across all kinds of sectors, whether it's, you know, kind of TikTok, BYD, or, you know, many others, it feels like Chinese companies have suddenly emerged as these formidable international kind of competitors. So maybe I can ask you, Yuxin, first, what changed over the last 5 years?
I don't think it's a matter of 5 years. Maybe it shows up in the 5 years, but there has been such huge change in the entire education system, in the people who start business, all the business you mentioned. These are started by entrepreneurs who might be born and raised in China, but they went through a US education system. They worked for some of the top tech firms and then returned to China. And they went back into a system which produces 2 million engineers a year, which they can hire, and who works what we call 996, 9 to 9, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. So that's what you need in tech, where speed of product development need to go really, really fast. I'll provide a small example here. I did some work on EV, and one of the experts I interviewed works with a Shanghai-based auto manufacturer, but also has a JV with a German auto manufacturer, as you would have known. And I was asking what's the development pipeline looks differently for the China EV brand versus the Europe-based brand. He was like, yeah, we in our German partner, they already they foresee the transition. And it's not just about building battery. You need a software-defined car. So you need to build OS all over again. So they hired 4,000 engineers across Europe. And here we have maybe 2,000 people. But 6 years onward, we are on our second iterations of cars running on the road. and our German counterparts has only come out with the first OS. And interestingly, they found it couldn't do over-the-air update on their OS software, and now they have to re-overhaul it, redo it again for another 6 years. And I asked him, how does that happen? And he said, you know, in software development, there are so many interdependencies. You can't have everyone working in different countries, and unfortunately, you can't have one of your team take 8 weeks vacation in the summer and come back and pick it up again. If another team raised a question this morning, my team will have it solved by end of the day, whereas my German counterpart will say, well, let's wait till summer vacation is over. So that unfortunately has explained a lot of the difference in terms of what you mentioned about product development speed of innovation. But I will say there is a limit to that. The younger generation of Chinese people are not going to put up with working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, forever. We probably won't take job from everybody in the world, I think. Yeah.
Graham, why didn't you chime in?
Yeah, so I want to say, Rob, you know, you said how come all these companies just appeared suddenly. I think these have been overnight successes, decades in the making, is the honest answer. Like if you look at Wang Chuanfu from BYD, he set his sights on building an electric car company, you know, from the early 2000s. He started off as like a battery maker, but he knew from day one, like this was going to be the ultimate end market. And, you know, this guy is a visionary, but also kind of a little bit psychotic with the way that he was so committed to reinvesting. And lo and behold, he's there. And then maybe why are you seeing these today in your markets? It's because China is so tough right now. It's so much easier to go to like Switzerland or Europe and compete over here, right? So that's what a lot of businesses are doing. I mean, I think you've written about Temu, for example. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyone else want to chime in on that one? Or? Yeah. So it's kind of interesting because in your opening comments, you all sort of described how kind of tough the situation is in China at the moment, which no doubt it is. But then when we started sort of riffing about the companies, I could see your enthusiasm about the competitiveness. So, you know, the tough situation the market is in today, are we looking, is it like sort of the US in 2008, 2009, great financial crisis, everyone's super pessimistic, but with the benefit of hindsight, it was cyclical and, you know, the US went on to bigger and better things a few years later? Or is it some kind of structural problem which is going to lead to sort of a, you know, the kind of permanent sort of challenges for the economy?
So I made the analogy that China right now is kind of like where the US was circa 2010, 2011, repairing balance sheets, aggregate demand is weak, animal spirits are in the dump. I think that part is cyclical. What is perhaps structural is the change in the international situation because China and the US are diverging. And I think that has all sorts of implications for you know, the risk of this asset class and the prospects for Chinese companies abroad.
Yeah. Fred?
Yeah, I would just comment that I think investing in China, you know, for the last 2 years versus going forward is probably going to be very different in terms of investment opportunity. You know, just from a, I don't know what the economy is going to do. I think China on a high level is probably just maturing as a country. And so GDP growth absolutely has to slow. But at the same time, you know, 2 years ago, most of our investments were made in 2022. That was a different period. You could find a lot of deep value investments back then.
You couldn't, or you could?
You could.
You could, yeah.
Yeah, because there was a lot of forced selling in the market, whether for, you know, various reasons. A lot of institutions were selling and a lot of funds themselves were selling. And so you could buy things for literally below net cash value. Even today, yeah, you can still see it. There was definitely more in 22, but even today. I think in the last couple of years, what's also changed is, you know, Chinese companies have started to return capital. Whether forced, whether for alternative motives, or whether truly to benefit shareholders, that's debatable. But they are returning capital. So Alibaba has bought back, call it 10, 11% of their market cap. You have companies that are paying back the entire market cap in terms of special dividends. Lufax is one of them, I think 96%. Huya, you know, that's a struggling business, but it paid back about 60%. So you are seeing capital returns. And if you did dedicate the time, you know, maybe you could have spotted some of these opportunities. But the problem is that you know, most of the capital in today's world is probably from the West, and there is less interest coming from the West, which means there are fewer people looking at the market. Also, in terms of just research analysts and sell-side analyst resources, you know, I saw a stat that globally there were 4,500 research analysts, that has gone down to 3,000. And a lot of that has actually come from Asia as well, which means lower coverage, which means fewer people looking at these ideas on an individual level. And so cost of capital has gone up. You know, perceived risk, whether real or not, that's gone up. Less liquidity, fewer people looking at these markets. You probably have to specialize and, you know, do real deep work and have the right connections and network to do the work in China, which requires time. That's an increase in cost of capital. And so you look at the Chinese markets trading call like 12 times PE. You know, that's a high single digit yield on your asset, you know, not including any growth. Earnings growth is looking to be about like 15% projected for this year. That's probably reasonable. But you can find companies that are trading at like 8 times to 12 times, growing 40%, 50%, while other things are trading at the same level and like not growing at all. So it's kind of a stock picker's market going forward, in my opinion.
Yeah, Sophia?
And I would just add for context, and I think I joined as an analyst at a time when a lot of actually global capital started coming into China, which is around like the mid-2010s era with the IPO of Alibaba. So like we've kind of only, we saw a long cycle, like a decade cycle of China exuberance and like something's happened. And I think for me, like what I see that there are definitely issues, whether structural or cyclical, and like what I see is, look, about two-thirds of wealth is still tied into real estate. And that is a problem that still has to be solved for, corrected for, as the government tries to encourage policies of investment elsewhere. Because when real estate prices don't increase like they've increased over the last decade, people just feel poor. And when people feel poor, they don't know what that discount rate for their own futures are. And so this is feeding into the current consumption problem right now. Is even if the government gave me $100 to spend, this was not America COVID, where like government gave me $100, let's leverage that and then spend it. You know, these are people who are in a country that is still developing their social, like their social welfare nets, where they have to think about taking care of the elderly as they get older, and thinking about all of that to be like, wow, like if I got $100 today, I'd be like, I'm saving it, you know, because I don't know if my wealth is going to improve. So I think there's actually some real issues that China just has to work through as a maturing country, that every country who's gone through this journey has kind of yet to work through. But on the other side, there's also a lot of opportunities, whether in terms of valuations or companies who also see this trend and capitalize on that. And so there's companies we see today, whether, you know, benefiting from like people shifting wallet share into travel from goods, or people kind of trading down and finding really good value in things, or people understanding that China needs to pivot into more deeper tech innovations. Those are all actually opportunities. And when you find companies that understand policy, because you have to, it's kind of like if oil companies don't kind of foresee commodity risk and how the pricing move and can't react to that, you know, good Chinese operators also needs to see the larger trends driving the economy and also how they benefit people and the living standards of everyone and take advantage of all those secular trends.
Yeah. So do you want to briefly chime in on that? Then I have a couple more questions before I pass it over to the audience.
Yeah, I just want to echo what Fred just said. I'm like, through my investment career, which has been 15, 16 years, this is actually the moment I love China. Because back in 21, I just look at all the stocks and people, sell sides are coming out with increasingly creative valuation metrics like, oh, PE is not good, PEG is not good, maybe let's do PS. Well, maybe let's do PS 20 years down the road. I'm like, what can I buy? So I couldn't find anything I want to buy. It was really, really hard. But today when I look at it, and like Rob said, I look at Japanese stocks, I look at US stocks and Chinese stocks, I just have to come back. There's such high quality business trading at such reasonable multiple. And believe it or not, with me managing such a tiny amount of money, I can get a direct access to Alibaba investor relationship and ask them, get them to answer my question on the footnote of an annual report. What's better than that for a stock picker?
It's always a good sign when investor relations return your calls quickly.
Exactly.
Okay, tariffs. a lot of Western companies are clamoring for protection from Chinese ones. Short-term and long-term, are tariffs bullish for the Western companies hoping to be protected, or for the Chinese companies which are potentially going to be impacted by them? Fred, you're smiling.
I mean, just very briefly, I would say that tariffs just buy you time, right? Eventually, the superior products will win out in one way or another, whether that's through lowering your cost enough to offset the tariffs, or just simply creating better products that everyone wants and is willing to pay a higher price for. And so I would say in the long run, you know, you would want to back the companies, as you were saying yesterday, that are being subject to the tariffs because everyone else is scared. In the short term, it's absolutely going to create a lot of volatility and a lot of noise, and it's going to create a lot of disruption inside of these countries, companies for how to reorganize. But I would say that, especially for a lot of consumer goods and you know, what we were just talking about, integrated supply chains, cheaper products, et cetera, most likely a lot of these companies will be able to find a way to offset the tariffs in one way or another.
Great. I think this speaks to a larger problem, Rob, which is that there's overcapacity in China. There is more being made than is being consumed domestically, and so Chinese companies are now dependent, increasingly dependent on export markets to absorb that extra capacity. And that is creating a lot of friction internationally. But the core problem here is that consumption is too low in China relative to its potential. So, you know, rough numbers again, I think consumption as a percentage of GDP in China is about 40%. And that might compare to like 70% in India, or maybe even 80% in America. So really, like, the structural change which is going to transform China will be, I guess, a shifting in mindset, policy, and everything, which raises that consumption as a part of GDP.
Yeah, I think this is an age-old debate, which we're probably not going to resolve today, but I mentioned yesterday I read this book about the Bretton Woods conference, and after the Second World War, of course, the US was the position of having this huge export surplus as all the European economies are on the floor, and the European economies were saying, hey, you need to get rid of this surplus, we need to import more. And the US is at the time the surplus manufacturers. No, it's your job, you need to like increase your exports. So it depends oftentimes. People, I think, are very self-interested when it comes to that. Yeah. Yishin, I think you wanted to chime in.
Yeah, so if you look at the US deficit versus China, I think the biggest category is consumer electronics. That will be like 30-40% of the total deficit. And if you just think about how realistic it is to either reshore those manufacturing or find a third country that can do it, it's just not a 1 year, 2 year, or even 5 year exercise. Apple started looking to move their entire supply chain to India about 6 years ago. Guess how much they produced out of India last year? 15%. Their goal is to get to 30% in the next 2 to 3 years. But you can say it is Chinese building too much for other countries, but it is also a decision actively by international companies to put their manufacturing base in China. The reason Apple can only manufacture in China at the scale is it's a very short life cycle product. Every year you need to make it, and the short selling season for Apple phones is very short. It's only 3-4 months between October when they announced the model till Christmas season. And that's where most, so think about the supply chain you have to manage and how many units for Apple is about 200 million every year. You have to manufacture that many for a 3 month selling period. So what you need is millions and millions of skilled worker who are willing to work 10, 12 hours a day, nonstop, for 3 to 6 months. And where do you find those labor force? Definitely not in the United States.
Well, I don't know, TSMC is pushing people pretty hard in Arizona.
hasn't really worked so far. So I think it can happen, maybe when robots and AI can do all those jobs someday, but it's going to be a very long exercise. So whenever I hear these news about tariff, my first question is, what is Apple trying to do, and how the conversation between Tim Cook and whatever the Treasury or the Department of Commerce is happening?
Yeah, that's a great point. Did you want to chime in there, Sophia? And then I have one last question before passing it over.
Yeah, so just on that, I think there's the tariff side of things, and there's two ways I think about it. One is, when you put tariffs on something, who's paying the ultimate price for it? It's the consumers. When everyone sees inflation go up again, I think it's going to be something that is going to be top of mind for politicians if you start to tariff, because China is just so efficient, right? Like, I didn't do well in economics, so this shouldn't come from me. Like, economics 101, you know, the country with the most competitive place to produce will end up being the producer. I think that's on one. And on the second end is, what happens when you tariff a country that is already so bent on survival, is you're forcing them into a more survival mode. And in Art of War, you say what you don't want to do is you don't want to force them to a place and then take out the ladder, because those people are going to fight to the very death. And so over the short term, it creates a massive volatility. It creates inflation in prices, but on the other end, all the Chinese companies that are going to be tariffed are going to be hell-bent on getting their prices to the lowest possible, even including the tariff. So over the long run, we are actually making China even more competitive if we tariff them in the way that a lot of economies are looking to do, as opposed to trying to think, how can we make our own companies more productive? How can we make our own people more productive so they can actually compete fairly and globally?
Just really quickly, I would say the best example of this, especially from the last administration, the Trump administration, was probably Huawei and the resurgence of Huawei. Because, you know, there were a lot of restrictions placed on Huawei under the previous Trump administration and whatnot. But if you look at the company today, it is thriving. They might have one of the most expensive cell phones out there at $3,000. It's a trifold cell phone. They have, you know, world leading cars, EVs, for instance. And my point is, like, tariffs are not, if you create great products, people will want them, and you might even be able to command a pricing premium for it. Yeah. And so just focus on bettering your product. And I think China is starting to get to a point where, you know, on a global level, their products are very, very good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people would be nodding their heads as you describe the strength of the Chinese companies, but I think a concern would be sort of ownership rights. So how concerned are you when you invest in China of getting your money back?
Well, I think that was a very big controversy and point of debate, you know, probably 7-8 years ago, right, with the BIE structure and whatnot. And I think the last 2 years, like I mentioned before, you're starting to see capital returns, and a lot of people didn't believe that you actually could return capital through the BIE structure, which, by the way, capital has been returning through that structure for like 20 years. But, you know, investors kind of omitted that fact. But yeah, you're seeing a lot more capital returns, and yes, it is a different structure, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's just whether is management on your team or not, and do they care about shareholders, and whether I'm a, you know, US company listed in the US or I'm a Chinese company through a VIE structure, if I'm looking to, you know, commit fraud or, you know, screw over shareholders somehow, I'm going to find a way, regardless of the structure, right? So, yeah.
So I mentioned before that I'm from Hong Kong, born and raised there. My family's there, so I'm kind of literally voting with my feet, skin in the game, all of that. Honestly, I'm not so worried about the scenario that you're describing, like expropriation or whatever. I'm more worried about like bad management setting my money on fire. and that's just through like bad capital allocation, which I've seen again and again and again and again. Either chasing growth when it's no longer like profitable, going into like non-core businesses, or my favorite, buying real estate. I'm much more worried about that.
Some of you may be staying in the Kempinski Hotel, which is a very beautiful hotel down here in the valley. That was financed by a Chinese entrepreneur. Okay, I have a million more questions I'd like to ask, but I'm going to pass the pass over to the audience. So Tommy, if you want to maybe grab one of the mics here and raise your hands. Is that Alex? Or I can't see. There's one at the back there. Yeah, take this one.
Question from the internet is just, could you comment on demographics? So real headwind, not a lot of desire for immigration to China, so hard how that's solved over the next couple decades.
Yeah, it's one of my investment themes. I mean, it happened before. If you just look at Japan, they reached a peak of population about 20 years ago. Economy wasn't great, especially we also coincided with them in terms of the real estate bubble went bust about the same time. But is this still investable? If you look at Japan 30 years ago, it was pretty investable. There are a lot of Japanese companies that create value in sectors like Uniqlo's of the world. You look at a large conglomerate, accumulated assets globally. There was innovation in tech space. I mean, we are stock pickers. We don't need to own the whole market.
Robots.
I like one word answers.
Next question. Just there. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
I think a common theme that I heard was like supply coming on rapidly. So two-part question related to that. What is this, like, what do you think is the source of that difference in supply? And then secondly, I think someone mentioned capital drying up in the country. How, if at all, do you see that changing that dynamic?
That's an interesting question. Fred?
Well, I would say just at a high level, how China typically operates when they enter a new industry is by throwing government support behind the industry to get to a, because there's a certain level of R&D and fixed cost that you have to cover in order to get to a place where you're competitive on a global level. So if you look at EVs at the Detroit Auto Show, you know, what, 15 years ago, you know, 14 years ago, people were making fun of those cars because the gaps between the door and the actual chassis was like 2 inches wide, right? But you iterate enough and you kind of throw money enough at it, at the problem, and iterate and then first serve your domestic market and then iterate there and then go globally, you know, that's typically how China has operated in the past. So a lot of that excess supply is kind of a remnant from that period of time, from ramping up that industry as well.
Yeah, whereby I don't think it does just justification to the strength of the entrepreneurship in China to suggest it's just because of capital, right?
So just to add to that, I think there's a recent book by Professor Xu Chenggang from Stanford that's called, I think, a Systematic Gene. And I think there's a really helpful analogy to say the Chinese system, you think it's a dictatorship, but it actually is a decentralized dictatorship, meaning the big policy are made in the center. However, among all the provinces, there is a competitive relationship. So coming back to this overcapacity issue, every government province is operating like this megacorp, and they are trying to maximize their tax revenue for the long term, maximize their employment in locally. So whenever they see a growth opportunity like EV, they're just like, I want the best EV company to be in my province. How do I compete with the next province to me? So you give 30% CapEx subsidy, I'll give 50%, and then I'll give 100%. So that's what happens. That's been a big problem. I think they need to solve that issue. So from some unofficial stats, I think there are 60 million auto capacity annually in China, and our annual sales is about 20 million. So partially it's because no provincial governments want their baby to go out of market, but it has to, because otherwise there's no clearance of this market and there would never be profitable companies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think, great question, Gabe, and I don't think capital is scarce in China. I think there's like an overabundance of it, actually. The problem is like it's not being allocated optimally. So you've probably heard of Evergrande, the property company. You've probably not heard of Evergrande Hangzhou, the Evergrande car company, which I think Evergrande launched as an attempt to get subsidies to keep you know, the real estate business afloat. So that's like an example of where it's not going so well. And then I mentioned before the example of like Caudi Coffee, which exploded from you know, zero stores to almost I think like 16,000 or so in 2 years. And that to me really speaks of like, unfortunately, like the desperation of some people looking to get a better return on their assets, given how weak their businesses are, maybe how vulnerable their jobs are, or the lack of other alternatives for their savings.
Great.
And sorry, I'll just add on one point to that supply thing. Was another anecdote would be the semiconductor industry and the decentralization that was mentioned. It's very prevalent, right? Like there's like a mandate, we got to invest in semis. Every local province is like, oh my God, I need to invest in semis. So they all, you know, put a lot of capital behind building up these fabs. But the thing about China you have to remember is as much as supply comes on really quickly, the environment also can rationalize just as quickly. I think back to the internet days of couponing and consumer subsidization supply in the O2O industry, what it was called in the 2010s.
The local services, yeah.
The local services, the online, offline, the local services, there was like Meituan, Ele.me, and a handful, Kobe, like all of these came up with these I basically will just pay to get consumer retention, LTV. And in the private side, I was like doing the data. I was like, you know, it started from like maybe like 100 companies or something, and like quickly rationalized like the second year, like cut in half, and then eventually it became like a three-player market, and now it's dominated like really by Meituan. So as fast as supply can also come on in China, it can also rationalize itself very quickly through competition because they just can't survive.
Great. Over there.
So my question concerns more the, as you mentioned, corporate governance and capital allocation as a way of destroying value rather than created in Chinese companies. And I would say, what's your opinion, and do you have any experience with doing activism on Chinese companies? And how is it received? What's the best way to do it? And also non-contested activism, so not Bill Ackman style, rather like more behind the scene and things like that. That would be like.
Okay, well, guilty as charged. I started my investing more on the quantitative side, and Hong Kong is just like littered with companies trading like well below book value, high dividend yields, all that kind of stuff. And me with my little pocketbook, I thought I could change the world by writing lots of letters and you know, getting in people's faces. It didn't work, unfortunately. You're very much pushing against closed doors. And I think, frankly, a lot of the people in control of the companies I was looking at had incentives other than raising the share price or creating value for me, a minority shareholder. So in the end, I decided, hey, it wasn't worth it. Yeah.
Well, back in my private equity days, we actually had a SOE privatization part of the business. So maybe not public market activism, but you actually need to go into SOE and fire people, try to change their structure. My summary is it doesn't work. I think the activism you can do is probably more like the friendly one that Rob does with most of these entrepreneurs that he invests in. If you build a trust with them, you can present them what you think is the right thing for business to do, and what is time that they should do capital allocation or shareholder return, how to structure those. And I think a lot of entrepreneur-led business are very open to those suggestions.
Yeah. Can I just add one more thought? So we're probably all familiar with like the 2021 tech crackdown in China, you know, when the government just kind of came out of nowhere and said, like, you can't do a lot of things. That might have actually been like one of the best things ever to happen for capital allocation in China tech, because they went from focusing on maximizing revenues and their reach to really focusing on maximizing earnings again and returning capital. So I think that's a great example, actually, of where the mindset changed. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like Will said earlier, if there's a sort of a fundamental openness towards it, there's but if people don't get it or don't understand it, then I don't think hostile activism will get you very far. Yeah. I think we've got time for one last question. Yeah.
My question, a lot of media outlets are painting a relatively negative view on China and China economy. I wanted to ask, do you have favorite media outlets or reading recommendations to get a more differentiated view on the Chinese economy?
Great question. Yeah.
I think first of all, I think there's a lot of media distortion everywhere, and sometimes the media capture bits and pieces because they want to be clickbait for everything. But I think to understand any country, if you're going to be invested in a country, go to the country. Do your own visits, talk to people who live there, and I think that's the purest sense of truth that you can get, because you can remove all the biases, you do the diligence on the ground, and so I actually close like half my news sources because it's all very much noise, and just go. Like right now when I go to China, I see the same thing that Fred sees. Definitely there are struggles, but at the same time I'm trying to get a sense of why things are happening, how people are responding, and I think that's that would be my best way of handling it.
I would also just say read very widely, so don't trust one single source. You know, I probably get like 10 different newspapers delivered to my inbox every single day. So, you know, Chinese media definitely is biased. Weibo is going to give you a different outlook than Twitter. So just read everything and then put together your own perspective on things. And then one, I'd say like Substack that I really love, and you know, I'm not involved anyway, so this is just kind of a plug for them. But Baiguan by Robert
Can you say that more slowly?
Yeah, it's spelled B-A-I-G-U-A-N. It's a Substack. Robert does a very, very good job of outlining what's actually happening in China from a Chinese perspective.
The cheeky answer is, if you see an economist who speaks and then gets banned 2 weeks later, he's probably saying something interesting. So go check that out. We can talk afterwards if you want the name. And then if you want something like more structural, like kind of really, you know, a framework for thinking about this, go read Li Lu's stuff. A long time ago, I translated some of his work into English, but recently he put out another piece last month, I think, where he gave some very specific like analysis on how he sees China and what he thinks the government should do. So I'd highly recommend that. His name is L-I-L-U.
Himalaya Capital.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would also give a plug. Fred wrote a letter a few years ago in the context of New Oriental, explaining what he thinks Westerners get wrong when they invest in China. So I would definitely give that a big plug as well.
Yeah, I think that was from the summer of 2021. And so it's available on our website if anyone wants it.
No, I have fond memories of that. Okay, well, we'll wrap up the panel there, I think. So a round of applause for the panelists, and then a few comments afterwards.